Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined here this week by Kate.
Hi.
And returning guest, Jess.
Hello.
This week, we're talking about ideal types. We're talking about how pop culture presents and shapes romantic and physical archetypes and how that collides with the real world and all that stuff. But before we get into that, what have you guys been enjoying lately?
Oh, God. That's a great question.
I mean, anything. I know it's a busy season. We're recording this right before Summer Games Fest.
Oh, you know what? I actually just started Fantasy Life I, The Girl Who Steals Time. It's really fun so far. I'm not super far yet. I want to say I'm about 2 hours. But, you know, you get to pick from, I think, like 15 different classes. And it's kind of just like this animal. So it's by the same people who it's level 5. And it's kind of Animal Crossing. And I've heard that it has like some dark, cloudy elements to it as far as city building, which I fucking love dark cloud. So I'm super about that. And then kind of like with Final Fantasy 14's job system, where it's like you can be, you know, you can do fishing or mining or be a lumberjack, but also, you know, you can be a mercenary or a paladin or a magician. And so it's very fun so far. I really do like it. And that's kind of the big one. I also have been playing some Fields of Mystria. And there's a new patch for that, or not patch, but like
it's coming up like soon, right?
Yeah, in July, it's gonna allow you to not romance, but like you can start dating people, which is a big deal. And you can get everybody in the town to 8 hearts now. The current limit is 6. Before that, it was 4. So they're getting pretty close to, I think, just being done with the game. And if you haven't played Fields of Mystria and you do like, you know, like the start, like I think it is already in early access, substantially better than Stardew Valley. The game absolutely rules. Highly recommend.
Yeah, my wife has been playing that and she said it is very similar to Stardew, but with a lot of quality of life improvements.
Yes.
And with maybe a slightly narrower focus.
Yeah, I would say slightly narrower. And like, I think the big thing for me is that the town is just a lot more charming. Like all of the characters are more charming. Like the dialogue feels a little bit more conversational. And it has like these kind of like 90s anime-esque characters. And I don't know. I just adore it. I think it is a fantastic game.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out. What about you, Kate?
Yeah. So I actually started playing Fantasy Life for review. We got our code a little late. But now Summer Game Fest is happening, so I have to put it down and go away because it's a game that is going to take a lot of time. But insofar as what I've been doing, I actually want to talk about a documentary. It's called Wick is Pain. I did not know that I could love the John Wick movies more than I already did until I watched Wick is Pain. You can watch it on Prime Video. It's on VOD. It is one of those things where you become really thankful that there are directors and filmmakers in the world that live and breathe a genre that people often just don't care about. I would actually say that horror, while we complain that horror never gets like the accolades or the awards, I actually think action gets even less because it's very easy for people to see violence and fight sequences and they're like, oh, that was just cool. But the reality is most of the time action directors have a much steeper hill to climb because they are having to make sure that they are using violence and fights as a way to tell a story, to tell relationships, and to refocus how you do that. It's a lot easier to film one person talking at a camera. It's a lot harder to film two people or one versus many fighting. And what Wick is Pain does is I want everybody to watch it. Because I think you get a good understanding of the levels of dedication, the sacrifices, and the talent that goes into being able to direct a film like this and to understand that there are times where you just have to trust your actors to let their bodies act. You get some background into Chad Stahelski, who is one of the directors on John Wick and has been the single director for the rest of the Wick series, back into when he was Tom Cruise's stunt devil, how he started, and also see like what he's given up to stay on Wick. And we also get to see Keanu very specifically praise stunt work. Like, that is something that we don't get enough of. I think outside of Tom Cruise, Chad Stahelski has been like one of the only other people that is like, stunt people need recognition, stunt people need better pay, stunt people need awards. And there's a specific part that I mentioned in my review where they ask Keanu, like, how, like, what does it feel like watching them? And he's like, I'm scared for them, but they want to be there. I just kind of sit and I watch and I clap when it's done. And he said, he ends up saying something like, they're playing John Wick 2. Like, they are John Wick as well.
That's really cool.
Cause that's an element that we don't think of. Like, stunt actors just aren't there to be barreled through a wall. They are also having to be the character, but they're having to be the character while they're falling down 20 flights of stairs, like in John Wick.
Like, we almost need like a, just some way to hide, you know, like when you pause on Amazon and it tells you who's on screen, like just to give people that context, just like a YouTube series of like, here's when you're seeing Keanu Reeves, here's when you're seeing the stunt double. Cause I think there's this assumption of like, oh, it's that one quick shot where I can't see his face and it's probably a wig. It's like, no, it's more than that. Like that guy, like you said, Keanu Reeves said, like, he's also playing the character. He's also doing it. Like,
yeah. And there, so there's the scene, I don't remember if it's two or three, I think it's, I don't know, where John Wick falls off the roof when he's talking with
and
Bowery
he hits
King.
Like five.
Yeah, that was practical.
Oh, wow.
That's wild.
That looked like and it that, sucked.
It, yeah, well, he actually hurt himself doing it the first take. Because they had tested it with different clothes and he didn't have as much traction when he was falling off the first awning. And so when he fell too much inside to the fire escape area. It didn't go down. And when he hit it, he was so close to hitting his head. And so like he's talking through the process of, I fell here. I just have to move 1 foot. And he moved 1 foot and he's like, and then I had to make sure that I moved the other foot. And he's talking you through this and they're showing the take, like him moving his feet and like that piece. And then they're like, okay, what happened next? And he was like, Chad asked me if I wanted to do it again. And he was like, yeah, but if we're going to do it, we got to do it in 10 minutes before I start feeling the pain from falling. And I was just like, and
holy
shit. I think when people see this, I think it may be hard for people to understand. And it's something that happens on the Mission Impossible movies too, where people think that these directors are just being auteurs in the negative sense of harming somebody. Mm-hmm. But it is so much of a collaborative team experience that when you're a stunt person, and I think what Chad gets very specifically, because he was a stunt person beforehand, is understanding how to work within limits, how to keep going to get a shot, and also how to like work within the larger group. And they talk a lot about that. So it's really good. Like I didn't expect it to be, I was like, oh, this is just going to be a promo for John Wick. It's like, no, like this is telling you the kind of dedication that goes into bringing action onto the screen.
Yeah. This is, if you're a, like a sicko for the production side of things, this is the movie for you. It sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds amazing. It actually reminds me a little bit of like, and I guess just this is my mind always tying stuff to like games, but it was something that I thought about recently. Clair Obscur is like obviously popping off right now, and is super beloved. And like the performances in that game are tremendous. They are so good. Just like, and but this does not only apply to the way lines are delivered. And I really do like, because I like recently did like a short little like interview with them that has yet to come out. But I'm still like, I'm like working on it right now. And then also just in like just like other conversations I've seen, like they're very, very quick to, in the same breath as mentioning the voice actors, like mentioning the people who did the motion capture and like mentioning the people who did the acting with their bodies as well. And it's something that I think that the games industry does get a lot more hung up on, like the voice acting component of it, where a lot of times the physical actors are overlooked. And so much of it, like I said, it is not just how some of those lines are delivered. It is the facial expressions. It is like the posture, the way that these people move, especially in like Clair Obscur. It is a very like flourish, like fluid move. Like it's, movement is a really important part of that game. And so it is cool to see that emphasis. And I think that like whenever they reached like a milestone, it might have been like the 3.3 million in 33 days or whatever. And they released a video of the main character's motion actress dancing. And it was like this performance piece. And it was really lovely. And it just kind of reminds me of that. It's like those overlooked people who bring like the physicality and also embody this role. But we don't always necessarily think of them because they're not as front facing, even though they are such a core part of it. So that's really interesting. I'll have to watch that.
Chad touched on that when he was talking about, he's like, you don't get into stunt work to be for everybody to know what you did. He said, but it's a really good feeling to sit in an audience and have them react to your scene. And you know that that was you. And you get to just hear it, or telling the, you know, your family or your friend, like, that was me. I fell 10 stories.
Well, because that's the thing. Like, what I was going to say with like the mocap stuff is those people and stunt actors too, like, it's, they're not just there to be a body. Like, you are not a stunt actor just to be ragdolled down a flight of stairs. You're there because you know how to be ragdolled down a flight of stairs. And I mean, same with video games. Like, I mean, even if you go back to like the first Mortal Kombat game, they still had like, I think, martial artists doing stand in to like do the poses. And it's like, yeah, like those are just like the bodies that we saw, but they were there because of their expertise. And that continues today, where like, I think, I could be wrong, but I feel like Ghost of Tsushima had like people who actually knew how to sword fight, like, you know, like stuff like that, of like, let's bring in people who can not just do the mocap, but do it authentically. Cause like, yeah, you could put anyone in a spandex suit with ping pong balls on it and have them swing a sword, but it's not going to look as good. So yeah, I'll have to check that. And it's called Wick is Pain.
Wick is Pain. And love that is something that they said on the set after Keanu blew out his knee.
Ooh, that's rough.
And they've all said it consistently. But if anybody, anybody listening wants to read my review of it, it's on butwhythough.net as usual. It's a really good documentary. Like, I don't know, man. We need to care more about people behind the scenes that get something going, whether that's the physical actors for games, any sort of mocap actor, really. Like the amount of work that goes into that. Like even I've been playing a lot of CFB recently, and like a lot of those animations, they're not just pulled from like riggers deciding to do it. They are having athletes come in and show them how they move, show them how they run a cut, show them how they juke. And that's, I don't know, underappreciated. Yeah. I would have never made that connection to Jess, but you're like 100% right.
Yeah, no, it's just like very much the kind of like faceless, thankless areas of those fields. And we should have a lot more, I don't know, appreciation.
Yeah.
It'd be very cool to see more like awards centered around those positions.
Definitely. Yeah, I feel like this is going to be a whole future episode now, because I'm just seeing all of the wheels turning in everyone's heads. Yeah, for me, couple things. I'll keep them all brief. One, I'm going to recommend a Blue Sky account, which is Gunpla Mom, which is literally this person got their mom into making Gunpla during the pandemic. And now it's just this like sweet old lady who just makes different ones and post pictures of it and her progress on them, and it's adorable.
I love that. That's so cute. This is
adorable. Oh my god,
it's so good. Second one, Elden Ring Nightreign, which I have not sunk a bunch of time into. It is Elden Ring, but then as fast as possible, which is chaotic and fun and stressful, and like I'm having a great time with it with my friends. But the number of times we've been trying to do something and someone's like, oh shit, there's the wall, run. And we just abandon whatever we were trying to do and just start sprinting. Also not having, feeling like I don't have time to read item descriptions or like what I'm doing is, I wish that maybe that part would slow down a little bit. Like, oh, you beat a boss, there was a drop, we're going to slow the wall down so you have time to make a decision. That's like maybe my one quality of life thing, but maybe that'll change as I play it more and get more familiar with what's available. But yeah, my first experience with it was like, I am thrown in the deep end. Everything's going so fast and I can't read fast enough to do this.
It's funny as that makes me want to pick it up specifically because like I wanted to play it because I'm a multiplayer person, but two, like I like moving fast, man. Like there's just something about like barreling through something, and I'm not even like a speed runner per se, But yeah, it just feels good. And it's a bigger challenge. Even when we were clearing like raids in 14, it's like, cool, how fast can we burn it? How fast can we skip this mechanic? How, like, it's just, I don't know, it's cool. Refer back to our Souls Like episode from last week.
It is. Yeah, it's cool and it's fun. And I think the thing that makes this one work is that because it removes all of the things that make Souls games usually take time. Like, you only level up to 15, and then also it resets once you all die. And you don't have to strategize your build. You just go, like, level go up, and that is it. You don't have to be, like, strength go up, dex go up. And so, yeah, it's great to just, like, hop in, play around with friends, hop out. And then the last one was Friendship, starring Tim Robinson and Paul Rudd. Have you guys seen this one yet?
No.
I have not, but I know that we have a review from it from South By, and our critic, like, loved it.
It's basically just like a super dark comedy. And it's like somehow it is a serious movie while Tim Robinson is still being full Tim Robinson. And that juxtaposition is a lot, but also like I was in a packed theater and people were laughing the entire time, but also on this like weird emotional roller coaster. And I had a good time with it. I thought he did great with it. Paul Rudd did great. Like everybody in the cast was solid, and the one thing I'll say is that it ends, I think, correctly, which is without as much resolution as you had wanted. Like, it does leave things a little untied, not in like a, ooh, maybe we'll do a sequel way, but just like wrapping this up isn't the point. Showing you is the point. And so that I really appreciated about it. But yeah, those are my three things.
I think that Tim Robinson and like Nathan Fielder is that's probably my nightmare blunt rotation.
Oh my God.
I can't get those two in the room together.
Like, I was just thinking, like, No. Absolutely.
I feel like we're speaking something into existence that we're going to regret.
Yeah. Anytime, like, because the rehearsal or whatever has been going on too. And it's like, I've just had so many random conversations about the two of them over the past year or whatever. And it's like, anytime anything is mentioned, I'm just like, oh God, they're. Yep. Such intense people.
They really are. It's a lot. But yeah, it was a fun movie. A lot of good jokes. I enjoyed it. Where can people find you guys online?
You can find me. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Say it in unison.
You can find me being annoying on Blue Sky at omithrandier. If you want to follow us as we travel and see any in the moment stuff from Summer Game Fest that we can show you, you can follow me on Instagram at omithrandier as well.
You can find all of my work on GameSpot. We're going to be at Summer Game Fest here. And well, actually, I think by the time this episode is up, it will be in progress. So be sure to check out all of our coverage in the coming week. And you can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram at A Wild Jessachu.
And you can find me on Blue Sky at Most Always Alex. I'm technically other places, but I don't use those accounts. So come find me on Blue Sky. And with that, let's talk about ideal types. Let's get into how Hollywood messes with perceptions, which I feel like the place to start with that is to define what we mean by a type, because it's the way I could explain it in my head is that it's the romantic offshoot of a stereotype, not just physical, but like the person themselves. Like it's a very much like a mold that you are looking for, if that makes sense. And so we round tabled before recording a couple examples, and we'll go through these kind of rapid fire just to give people like a handle on it. Silver haired anime men. I think this was Kate. Do you want to explain this one?
The silver haired anime man often has a scar, may not specifically, not a requirement, but they are better if they have more scars. Often come with a lot of trauma. They live in the moral gray. Yeah, I don't know how. Yes.
Yep.
They will take care of you in many ways.
Yeah, which this feels adjacent to our next one, which was the scoundrel, the Han Solo type, where it's like, awesome. I'm tough and mean, but also.
Okay. I'm soft, but only for you.
Yes.
See, this is the difference. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll use Vegeta as an example. He's not silver haired, but when Vegeta first comes in, he's ready to just genocide another planet, right?
Yes.
Does not care, unrestrained, beginning of his relationship with Bulma, kind of treats her badly. That's the reality mm-hmm. of it. That's just who he is, but he's real hot, so you're going to stay. The Scoundrel is like the evolution of that.
Yes.
It is the, I will, like, I am the largest asshole in the entire world, but not to you.
Not to you.
You are my precious, and I will take care of you, and I will do exactly what you find. And in Vegeta's example, he will go find all of the Dragon Balls to allow Bulma to be 5 years younger.
Yes.
And he will do it as many times as he wants, as the films have revealed, are a lot. Homegirl just says, I want this, go get Dragon Balls. He listens. Or in a Daima, there is a scene where he just wants to fight, but the reality is he'll probably die fighting. And Bulma's just like, if you don't come down here right now, we will never shower together again. And then he just immediately, like, that is actually what she says. And he just immediately comes down and is like, Kakarot, you have this.
Incredible motivation. Mm-hmm. So good.
We love a wife guy.
Yeah. And well, and then there's the final evolution of this, the dangerous wife guy, which I assume that for, is this closer to like nobody John Wick type territory?
I always think of Dracula with this one, like Castlevania Dracula. It's like, these people fucked with my wife. I now hate all of humankind.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we had the most obvious one, goth girls. Where I feel like this is such a trope in media, and it's disingenuous to the idea that like there is a whole subculture around goth. Mm-hmm. So to be like, that's my type, it's like, is it the aesthetic that's your type, or is it like everything that comes with that aesthetic? Like, that's a big difference here. And then Spicy
I've
Latina,
learned with some people that they just want somebody to be mean to them, which goes into
I was
the spicy
gonna get
Latina.
Into that because yeah. I also wrote on this list whatever Shigo had going on, but that's the category of I want her to be mean to me.
Yes.
That's its own. I don't even know what you call it. Is that just Shigo? Is that the type? It's just I want her to be mean to me.
Yeah,
I guess I kind of think like maybe it's like a subset of like femme fatale, kind of like an evolution of that.
Yeah.
Because when I think of like the like women, I always think like the old school, like and this goes back into, you could go into like feminist studies with this, right? And like how a lot of times it's like you have like the mother, the virgin, and like the crone and the whore, and like those are like everything kind of falls into one of those. But it's like, you know, the ingenue and the femme fatale were kind of like the two sides of like an attractive woman. It's like you either want somebody who's very pure and innocent, or you want someone who's going to step on you and who's not.
Yes. Yeah. That's a perfect example. I think
what we should maybe clarify is like really all of these, like these are just like quick, like shorthands for types of people in media, but with romantic appeal. Whether or not that romantic appeal is like the best choice for you because of the whole like, hey, step on me. Because I think a good example where this actually doesn't work is Resident Evil Village, where I think people just wanted to be stepped on. I don't think that there was like a type being presented.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, so like you get the idea. There's like the girl who grew up with brothers, the guy who grew up with sisters, being presented as
we
these,
are
like,
missing the golden retriever, like that's actually
ooh,
what
yes,
I was
yeah,
thinking
yeah.
The golden retriever.
I think adjacent to that, the himbo a little
oh,
bit.
Oh yes,
the himbo. Yeah,
yes.
I always, one of my big things is like the mentor type. I feel like that's always one that I enjoy.
Yeah. Yes. Do you have any good examples of that one?
Yeah. So like that, those would be like your Obi-Wans. They would be your Kakashi. Your Aizawa, like generally, and I Aizawa. Think that this also ties into like teacher crushes or like the power dynamic thing.
That's a good
like
call.
Not to psychoanalyze myself too much, but I think that it is. I think it's like wanting someone who's older and who takes care of you and who's like very proficient and skilled and valuing that.
And who better for that than Alec Guinness?
That's
who
McGregor.
We were talking about, right?
Or also another one, Sirius Black. Harry Potter kind of sucks, but that's another one that I think of, though, because I know some people are like into like that mentor figure too. Yeah. But it just people like that.
He's a mentor figure mixed with I can fix him a little bit.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of mentor figures actually kind of live on that line where they're kind of, they're like a little bit obsessed with their job or like with their like they're perfectionists and they tend to like be a little dark and moody usually, or at least have like that little bit of a streak to them where it's kind of like, I want them to take care of me, but I also want to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But then you also want that intensity of they're like, I care about you so much. That's why I'm so like rough, like trying to like push you.
Exactly.
Like, I think the mentor is like a really, really good one. I do think the funny thing for me is never in my life have, because I like himbos. I like gold. I have liked golden retrievers. Mm-hmm. What the hell is Goku? I don't think he's either of those. He's just dumb. I don't like, because I have never been attracted to Goku. And it's this very specific personality that I can't really name. Like, Goku is the anti-ideal.
I think that the big thing, I think that Goku is like adjacent to that, but he's not necessarily like thoughtful enough is maybe the problem. Is he's like kind of a little bit like, he's clueless, but not necessarily in an endearing way. It's kind of more of a like, you're not thinking about other people way. And also he's kind of a deadbeat dad. And like, that's not sexy.
Somebody tried to argue with me one time about Vegeta and Goku, like, and marriage potential. And I was like, you're not going to win this. Like, Goku, we know Goku has had sex at least twice, right? With his kids. Or was it three? Mm-hmm. Is it three kids or two kids?
Goku canonically has not kissed his wife.
Yeah. Like that is the issue, which is like when Bulma is like, honey, I'll never shower with you again. Goku's like, what is she talking about? And everybody's like, Goku,
I say Goku, it's like Goku's like borderline ace.
Yeah. His real wife is fighting. Like he and I think that's what it is like, I think what makes an ideal type, especially when you go towards the darker edge of the spectrum, is there has to be that little bit that does actually care and invest in something else other than themselves. Because that Goku type is 10 times more selfish than I just blew up an entire planet, Vegeta.
The only other one I can think of, and this kind of I think ties into scoundrel and dangerous wife guy, because this is like a very popular romantasy character now, which like romantasy is a book genre that is like a subset of like fantasy, but it has an emphasis on romance and generally is more like erotic. And the biggest thing in that genre are shadow daddies. That is what they are called. And they are generally domineering men who tend to have a bad boy streak and who generally come across as evil at the beginning, but then you find out they were being evil for like very specific reasons. They were doing it to distance themselves from you, to protect you from getting too close to them, or because, you know, secretly the people you think are like the good guys are actually the bad guys, and now you know the truth. And they generally have like some sort of dark power, like they can control shadows or like blend in with, you know, something like that. Like they have some sort of dark skills. And that is a very popular trope in that genre.
I will say, going off of that, because I thought about it too, I think the BL trope of, but I actually think it would be like any like manhwa or manga, the Yakuza or the mafioso.
Oh yeah.
Like give me a mob boss. Like he, and like, you know what? What I like about that one, kind of similar to the Shadow Daddy, is like everything he does, you're just like, this dude is evil. He does not care. And it's like that for like 50 chapters. And then like, and maybe a little top card in there. But like chapter 52, he realizes he's actually in love with the person that he's with. And then it's like, oh, okay, I'll still go murder everybody and be the murdery person. But oh, I love this person. They can say, now I'm going to turn into the murderous husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like a lot of these are about people who are so thoroughly one thing, except for like one little streak in them. Because like I was thinking, the other example I put in here was like literally all of the Breakfast Club, except maybe Brian, as being like romantic archetypes for somebody, including Claire, who's like the good girl, kind of like rebelling against her parents, and like, and then, you know, Bender is like the babiest of the dangerous wife guy family tree that we laid out earlier, where it's like, oh no, you're just someone who like is not dealing with their traumatic upbringing well, but like you want to, and you want to care about someone. And again, it's, all of these having like a romantic appeal to people, like they see it and they're like, I want that, like this is my type.
Interesting. There's a lot of media that is just completely focused around, I mean, so that's part of the reason to like tie it to stuff like K-pop, right? Like, or even just like Western boy bands or like girl groups. It's a lot of it is like they have these large groups, because that's one thing with K-pop, right? People are like, why are there like 14 people in this band? Like, that is so unnecessary. Why? And it's like, because that guarantees that there is one person in that group that is going to appeal to a very specific like young girl.
We and, have
like,
they 14 are market demographics and we're hitting them all.
And like, and they very deliberately like establish a persona that like, I'm sure some they're of it archetypes. Is that person. Yeah, they're archetypes. Like, and they even have like, look at stuff like Oranho's Club, right? Like that, the whole thing with that is like, you have these, this group of guys that are all like these established archetypes in anime. Or if you even look at something like party compositions in RPGs, like the reason why Persona has, you know, like the lovers person, and it's always, you know, like the on or the, oh my gosh, why can I not think of like, but you know what I mean? Like it's always kind of like the more feminine, like, I don't know. I hate, because I love like On and Co, but I look at that. They're considered usually like the ditzy, like more girly ones, right? And then you have like the Mitsurus, who are a little bit more serious, and like they, these things all exist in an attempt to hit every demographic. Yeah. You know, like there's a lot of media that is structured that way.
Well, and that's what it is. These are ideal archetypes ultimately. And they're broadly made, and they kind of, they hit where their genre hits, which I, why I actually think it's funny to have Spicy Latina in here. But I do think it's important. And I, like, I remember I used to hate it. And then I heard Sofia Vergara talk about being on Modern Family. And she's like, no, a lot of that is actually me. She's like, yeah, there's some hyperbole, but like, I'm loud. I'm passionate. I will fight somebody if pushed to that point. And it's one of those things where, like, I think I was so worried about stereotypes when I was growing up. Now I actually do think there's some validity behind that. Like, I think Ben Affleck like told Remezcla that he like wasn't done dating Latinas, and I was like, yeah, this dude wants to be yelled at, like this is the type that he's coming to.
Have you seen any photo of this guy? He wants to be yelled at.
He does, exactly.
That brings us to this idea of like, what do we not mean by type? And I think that that's a good example of like, there is a way that that's your type that is very fetishy.
Yeah.
And that like, and then there is like the, are you seeing the whole like the whole person, the whole view of it? Cause like all of these are kind of combinations of like personality, vibe, aesthetic, culture, stereotypes, like all of those things kind of get wrapped up in this to form these like ideal types. And there's, if you are ignoring some of those components to zero in on the one you want, like physicality, that's where you're in that fetish. Wait,
booty Latinas.
Yeah.
Which I prefer, like if somebody is like, we're going to do a Latina archetype, I prefer Spicy Latina to Big Booty Latina. I appreciate, I would love to be considered Big Booty Latina. That ain't never going to happen because I don't have that back there. But Spicy Latina, I think, gets at the personality traits that are assumed, or the elements of a person that you're going to that is beyond just Big Booty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, and at that point, you're on beauty standards.
Yes. I say it is... to a certain extent, right? Like archetypes are stereotypes, or at least rooted in that to an extent.
Yes.
But there are some that are at least like humanizing and cognizant of culture and personality. And then there are others where it is like not that. And that's where stuff like Big Booty Latina, like that would totally fall into, you know.
Yeah.
Very, very physical and very shallow.
Yeah. And it's hyped. And it's you know, good to do that introspective work on yourself and to know why you like these things. Like, really, what we're asking you to do as listeners is to interrogate your thirst and to like understand where you're coming from with all of this, because you don't want to be dehumanizing. You do want to see people as people. But yeah, because I think it is important to say though that like, yeah, like the fetishization and beauty standards parts of this is all part of the conversation. Like, the, you can't get away from it. But I think it's definitely adjacent, not quite in it, or a Venn diagram maybe. But yeah, I love. Oh, go for it.
I was gonna say the note that you have on here next is kind of just like, you know, failing to see the whole person, and you wrote, you know, like goth people, for instance, because like that is such a huge thing. Like the amount of guys who I see thirsting after like really hot, like alt or goth girls on Instagram, and then hate the music, hate the subculture. Or like I've seen these different like posts where it's like, oh, when you're on Tinder and you see a really hot goth girl, so you have to pretend to like, you know, leftist politics. And it's like just like predatory evil shit.
Yeah.
Where it's like you do not respect, I mean, first of all, women, but also this girl who you are courting, who, you know, I don't know. I also think another one that comes to mind to kind of go back to K-pop, because I've seen a lot of people do this too, is where you become so engrossed in all of that, where there are some girls who are just like, oh, my type is Korean men. Like, it just like point blank. And it's like, like, right. And then they kind of have these expectations from absorbing fan fiction and like these very curated personalities in these bands. Mm-hmm. That is what Korean men look and act like.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's where you have to interrogate your thirst and be like, so what is it about Korean men that you're attracted to? And does it go beyond what you've seen in BTS concert videos?
Like, yes.
Yeah. And that's like one of the things that I think also comes up too, because I think like specifically on that point, I remember, I think on Instagram, there was an Instagram reel where this lady was like, I went to Korea and there was nobody like what I see in K-dramas. I was lied to. It's like, baby, have you seen Hollywood? Like, no, it's the production. Like, people are people.
It's like somebody was like, I went to America. And nobody looked like, yeah, man, that's not what we look like. By and large, those people are selected and it is a small group.
Well, and it also just fails to like recognize, and people do the same thing, I think, with like Japan too is another one where people are, they like not only fetishize the people, but like fetishize the culture to the point where they don't recognize like for instance, like I have a friend who, you know, is living in Taiwan right now, and who like has kind of now had more conversations about like dating and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it is a lot more common for men to not really care about cheating. Like it is considered less of a bad thing. It's not quite seen the same way as it is like here. And like there's just cultural differences, and there's also, you know, like differences in politics and like kind of the societal views. And it's like, and you don't want to stereotype too far and go that way either, but it's like there's nuances, right? Like there is a lot to unpack. And so when you have like this very I don't know, you expect to go over there and meet your K-pop boyfriend, and also it doesn't, like the beauty standards too, right? And the plastic surgery and like all of this shit is all packaged together, and it makes for something that is very messy, very nuanced, and there are a lot of people who see it very superficially.
I mean, and that also just gets into the whole weirdness of like not just the plastic surgery that they have to maintain there, but like the plastic surgery that people get to look whiter. And like there's this weird like everybody
skin
trying
whitening.
To yeah everyone trying to like, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, reach across the aisle, but in all the wrong ways, like and it's not great. I don't know, I just like, I mean, even going through all those types, I'm like thinking through like, okay, well, like what types have I had and how has that informed like who I've dated throughout my life?
I think the funny thing is I've been pretty like upfront that I'm very certain that the Green Ranger, Han Solo, and Indiana Jones are the reason that I have been with Matt for 11 years. I mean, I love him, so like this is him, but those very early crushes, like I want somebody who's a little bit of an asshole to other people. Like I want somebody to have a resting face that maybe like, is that like, what is that? That big dog privilege or whatever that you see on like Instagram, I'm just walking with them and I don't got to worry about anything. Mm-hmm. And, but there's also like that sweetness that comes with it. Like that's on the outside that only I get to see. And it's like, well, that's special for me. And like, that's mine. And so like, I think that definitely like, but if I kind of break it down beneath that, like I think the reason for me that I'm still attracted to those types of characters in film and books and manga and is because there is a level of competency and confidence that comes from those characters, even when they may not be doing something that they may be doing something they don't know what to do, but they never question if they can do it. They just find a way. And I think that that is something that I find extremely attractive. And I think for me has always been like a pushing me further type thing. And I do think Vegeta falls in there too, which is also an early crush. So for me, I think that like, as we kind of like interrogate our thirst, I think that's really what stood out. Cause I've been thinking about this since we like did the notes and had the first conversations for this. Is like, I always like, I share that like, these were my, these are my first romances when I was young. And like, I feel like the person I'm with kind of like embodies that, but it's like, but what about it? And I think it is that competency and confidence and above everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's, I mean, honestly, you're bringing more awareness to this than I think most people do when they think about like what they watch and how that informed who they
became. I've had a week, Alex.
No, it's good. It's good awareness to have, because now I'm just like, okay, like, do I, if I string out like all of my pop culture crushes, I'm like, is there a pattern? Is there anything? Or have I just been even shallower than that, that I'm not even forming like a full picture of a human being?
Hey, some shallowness is fine.
It like, is. I just, yeah.
Like, it's my requirement. Yeah, I'm like, my requirement that every fictional character that I like in a romance novel is a, like 6'5 and above, that is shallow as can be. The tallness has nothing to do with their personality. Yeah. I would just like them to be a tree.
You know what's funny is like, Kate, when you were talking, it made me kind of reflect on my relationship. And I'm like, is there like a through? And I'm like, there is a line. There is a through line to me being with Andrew, because Andrew was older than me in high school. I mean, he's older than me now, but you know what I mean? Like he was
stopped aging.
Yeah, so he stopped aging. But no, and he was the editor of the high school paper. And I joined staff, and so I was kind of known in high school as being like in like the punk alt, right? You know, like my best friend had like a giant mohawk and stuff. And so when I joined newspaper, and we were both like music-y people, but he had like a music column, and then he got promoted to being like the editor in chief. And I was like, I want to take over his music column because I think his music taste sucks. And then I went in there, and he thought that I was just like a punk and was like very annoyed with me already. But yeah, he was the editor in chief, and I was just constantly seeking approval, and I ended up developing a crush. And then it was like kind of bad because it's like, oh, he's the editor. And like, it doesn't really fucking matter when you're in high school. But in my mind, I was just like, well, I don't know if I can have a crush on him. He's older, blah, 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 blah. And there is that like mentor. And then he started he purposely, because he had a crush on me too, assigned it to where he and I were working together on like, we would like once a month, we would have like layout night where we're there until like 11 o'clock finalizing all the news stories, like laying them out on the page. And it would always be two people working together, and he made himself working with me. And so he's sitting there like going over stuff with me, and I'm like, I'm falling in love with you. And now it's been, 15 years later, but there is a tie there because he was totally in like a mentor position. And I was like, I look up to you and I just want you to like me.
That is perfect. I feel like these things do go deeper than we think, honestly. Yeah, I think we just don't put two and two together until we kind of look back on things.
Yeah. I mean, well, because now I'm thinking through mine, and it's just like pop culture crushes have been like largely independent, strong opinions, ready to throw down on things. And then I like look at my wife and I'm like, yeah, okay. Like that's who I married. Like very self-assured, very like, I know what I believe. And then I'm like, yeah, this tracks. This is all the women that I've had crushes on in pop culture.
It was funny. I remember, cause I'm thinking about Matt's type. I'm like, huh, who do you go for in things other than archers? Like if there's a lady with a bow and arrow, like he's
sold.
That's his 6'5" lady bow and arrow. But like, I remember very specifically when I started dating him, he told me that like the reason he reached out was because he saw I was in a PhD program, and it wasn't intelligence. It was that I was my own person. Yeah. Like I wasn't coming in. And I kind of like when I attach like the people that I've seen, like he loves Ilsa Faust from the Mission Impossible series because she doesn't need Ethan. She's on her, like she's there and she will take care of herself and she will do it. It's nice to have Ethan, but like, and so so much. I think everybody should do this exercise because it's actually really cool to like think about like historically the types that you've been gravitated to in pop culture, and even think about what your partners have gravitated to and kind of see those parallels and those elements.
Because there is overlap. Because I feel like when I first had this, the idea to even do this conversation, I was like, this is really more about like how pop culture is and isn't responsible, but like, because I'm like, nobody's like picking their whole type off of what they see. But now as we're talking, I'm like, we kind of do a little bit.
We kind of do, yeah.
Like we don't consciously do it. But yeah, like what we are seeing is informing it. And it's why it's also like important to write good, thoughtful characters who are not just like these, you know, very limited molds, these very small lists of character traits. Because, you know, that expands what people might be open to if they see it more. Not that these are bad things, because I think we all found partners that we very much love based off of the fictional characters that we loved.
I just like that I've now found out that Kelsey is Shego. So that's
important. I mean, maybe a little bit, yeah. I was going to say Ashley Spinelli.
Oh.
Is the other one. I had a big crush on Ashley Spinelli as a kid.
So funny.
I think one of the things I was going to say too, I think that this kind of opens up even a larger conversation, which is maybe tangential, but like when we think of the ways that pop culture has influenced our ideal types and what we're looking for, I think it's also ideal. It's also given us sometimes our first interactions, especially when you're coming up with, with things you want to do, things you want to try, fantasies, what you expect from a romance, whether you wait for somebody to call you back or you call them first, or, you know, and I think that like all of that is put into us by what we see, read, play, but we kind of, through our own experiences, we kind of chart our paths through those kind of peaks and valleys to find stuff. But that first piece, so like, I do think it's important to write like really thoughtful characters. I also think even when it's bad, and I'm going to talk about 50 Shades of Grey here, even when it is horrible and a bad representation of something, it can also open doors for people to explore and find different things about themselves. And I think that media is very powerful, and romance novels, novels, whether it's romantasy or smutty comics, I think it gives you a safe space to figure out what can I ask for in a relationship, what can I do, what can I see. And it may not be, it's definitely not going to be one-to-one. You are not a fae and he is not a shadow daddy. But it can maybe give you the vocabulary to explore things. So I actually think these ideal types go into a larger landscape of romance. Like I'll stop talking because that was a lot. But
No, I think that was good because it's, I mean, realistically what it is, like what you identified is that It is that first exposure thing. And it's also a broader exposure to the types of people that exist in the world. And I think that that's what's important, because like realistically, you're not going to date every type of person to figure out what works for you. Like, having that, and, you know, having that being something that you have like kind of like in your head as a fantasy of like, I like this, this is good. Now, I think there's also times where like you need people to check those fantasies, like before the call, Jess and I were talking about the Notebook. And how people have largely turned on that because they were like, oh, it's not romantic to threaten to kill yourself if someone won't go on a date with you.
Yes, like, yes.
And you need a friend to sit down and be like, hey, what do you like about this? Like, why is that your type?
Well, it's like I read some romanticy. I feel like I am probably harder on it than, I don't know. Like there's some that I really, really like, but there's some that I just cannot get into. I recently read one that's called Butcher and Blackbird for my book club, and it is one of the worst books that I've read. I'm so sorry if you're listening to this and you're a fan. Just because, like, so much of the sexiness was not sexy, but that in itself is a way for me to explore some of my feelings, because I'm just like, you know, there are some people that is super appealing, but to me, did absolutely nothing. And so, yeah, you know, like it's interesting. And I do think that this also reminds me of conversations I've had with friends over the years who, you know, specifically with like video games or even like online games, who used those as resources to kind of explore their gender or their sexuality. Like, I have a friend who, what's so funny is back when we had this conversation, he had not transitioned, but was talking about like, oh yeah, like I used to, like, I liked girls, so I would pretend that I was a guy that way, you know, like on Gaia Online or, you know, whatever, or like I, like that way I could, and it's so funny because that was literally like before transition, and it's like, That was kind of a way, though, to allow him at the time to explore relationships with women. And now we can see, like, clearly that was also a way to explore gender, too. And, you know, so I think that that is also another cool part of that, on top of being able to explore fantasy and.
I mean, and I don't even, and I didn't, I mean, I've thought about it before, because I think for me, like, finding Yuri, like, finding, like, girls' love stories in manga was probably one of those, like, moments where I started, like, thinking about stuff. And I think in general, too, like, at, like, Willow, very specifically in Buffy. I know, like, this is what sucks about Buffy, is I know that Joss Whedon sucks, but Buffy is so fundamental to me and how I have grown and what I have explored, because it was some of the first times that I was seeing ideas like this, or that people like this could exist. And like, like Willow was very specifically one of the first, Dark Willow specifically, one of the first times where I was like, oh, girls,
you're allowed to do that.
And it was, and I think that there's like pop culture, like as much as we definitely like see these elements that push heteronormativity or push really deep body standards, there are like little just safe cocoons within them too, where you're able to explore queerness and you're able to explore gender and you're able to safely see what makes you feel. And I know it's kind of like amorphous, but it's one of the reasons why like I have pushed back so hard. Traditionally, a lot of people think that like people, like girls, women, straight or not, who read BL are fetishizing gay romances. And to a certain level, that can be true. But I also think that there is another way where it is sometimes easier to explore your own sexuality by reading something analogous to it or close to it, especially because right now, Yuri, which is girl's love, is predominant in the same way that like BL is predominantly written by women. Girls' love is predominantly written by men, and a lot of the times it looks very different. Same thing with like smutty, like heterosexual romances, but BL has been a vehicle for a lot of queer women and for a lot of women in general to explore different types of romances. And so I think when we look at like the breadth of popular culture and how it picks what we like, it is just kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like a buffet. Like you go up there and you put some things on your plate, and some of them you go back for and some of them you don't. And that's actually really exciting.
And it's a much safer way to do it, I think, than to just like actually mix it up with people. Like, not like that there is a time for that in your journey, but like it's not always the best place to start, you know.
Well, it reminds me of a quote that I read recently that was about something like different. It was talking about like the manosphere and stuff, right? And it was saying that a really big problem with that, and like a solution, because a lot, I mean, the biggest solution, right, is empathy. And a way that you could instill more empathy is in a way that a lot of women, I guess, gain that is having more interest in like fantasy and reading and in fiction. Whereas like a lot of male readers tend to read like nonfiction. Like it is way more common for women to turn to fiction. And that can be a really great way of learning about things that you don't know about, and seeking and like literally putting yourself in another person's shoes and gaining that compassion and that empathy for people. And I think in a similar way, it is really important, and perhaps we'd see, and this even ties back into the manosphere, like less sexual frustration and anger and awkwardness, if we did see more people engage with not necessarily just like porn, right? Because like I don't think like I don't like I'm not like anti-porn, but I just like that's not like necessarily the healthy way of portraying it, but just like different types of romance and you know, like tenderness and sex and stuff that's not tender, but just like observing that and reading about it, as opposed to like, you don't necessarily need to go out and I don't know, like I think that having that internal time and like that, like study sounds very like formal, right? Very academic, but it kind of is like a self-study when you engage with that stuff.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. Cause I think that like when people think it's funny, I fuck with people because I, when we go to book people here in Austin, I will go in, I'll go to the smutty manga section. I will literally buy porn manga and that's fine. But there's also like a really sweet story in there sometimes.
Yeah.
But what I think that that shows is like, I do think you're right, is I think we see a lot of young men very specifically going towards porn, but like women also engage in sexual fantasies in media. But there is a whole spectrum of that. Mm-hmm. Like, smut is there. And, like, and I think if we, it's weird because I think if there was more destigmatization in the same way that we have been doing it for women in these spaces, I do think that it makes it easier for there to be exploration. Because as much as I think that it's accepted that men watch porn, I still think the fact that there are so many ads saying that this is like a moral failing and we should ban it and you need to be saved by God because you shouldn't be doing this, I think that all of that really plays into that shame and self-loathing that just perpetuates into that incel culture that they really can't get out of. So now all they have left is Andrew Tate. And I do think that there is, like, on the point of empathy, I do think that there is an empathetic stance that you do have to take when you are looking at what is happening to young men, because they, they're in a pipeline. And the only way to get them out is to actually understand what they're going through. Go read more smut. Does that be fairy smut? Go, like, I'm sure somebody's written a World War II smut book. Like,
oh, guaranteed.
Come on. You can go do that, men.
And it's interesting because part of this is, like, I think, you know, it goes both ways, right? Like it's a matter of, like, young boys. I don't know. I don't want to completely absolve them of the choices they make and stuff like that. But at the same time.
Oh, no, please don't.
We do have a society that, like, largely does not cater to giving them the option to explore feelings and, and, like, I don't know. It's just, it's very, we've gotten better with time, but at the same time, it's not enough. We don't necessarily care for our young men and boys the way that we should. And we don't give them, I think, the same depth and attention as young women.
There's a podcast that I think is like really kind of necessary to listen to. It really kind of changed the way I thought about some stuff. It's a Trevor Noah's show, What Now? And they sit down with a guy who's talking about like the problem with young men right now. And one of the things that they do actually show is that when they have run like cognitive studies, women can face the exact same amount of single parentness, class elements, anything. Like, you can stack up the marginalizations and make it very similar between a man and a woman, and or the boy and the girl. And the girl will deal with it better because of mental progression, just cognitively how our brains develop, how we develop faster. And the fact that because we have lived in a society that has been so oppressive, we have developed other ways to cope. And the women in our lives that we still have, which we usually do not lose, have been able to show us those avenues. So we are able to cope and deal with that, those pressures and those external factors in a healthier way. Young men who lose male role models, they're not really given that same piece. And you could say, oh, well, a mother can do this. Like, there is something very critical about having a male role model in your life if you are a young boy. And because of that, men react, I don't want to say worse, but react in a more sensitive way. They just don't have the levers to flip to get a way out of that, or to learn how to take the other paths. And it's almost like with the correction of allowing, of removing oppressive systems, which we should do. Don't take this as me not saying that. We have also forgotten what happens when we do just kind of take the, like, the 12-year-old and say, oh, well, you're privileged over here. And it's like, well, he should still deserve to learn how to explore his emotions in a healthy way.
Yeah, like, and you should still be giving them a camp counselor to, like, lead the conversation.
Yes. And instead, we just kind of, like, oh, we'll just figure it out. you're a boy. And like, and we, everybody reinforces that patriarchal standard on them and like mm-hmm. toxic masculinity. When we talk about it, like there are ways in which like I contribute to that or that other, like, and we mm-hmm. don't even realize it because we've been in it all our lives. But yeah, anyway, it's What Now by Trevor Noah. You should listen to it. I think if you're a parent, you should listen to it. I actually gave it to my cousin to listen to because she's raising a son right now. And I think it's just very interesting because right now young men are actually, I think the stat is if you go into a morgue and you see five people who've died by suicide, four of them are young men. Mm. Like it is an astronomical rate that is much higher. Yeah. I don't know how we got here, but like, yeah, like I don't want to absolve anybody, but yeah, it's a lot.
You make such great points. I'm really glad that you said that. And like, I definitely mm-hmm. want to listen to that because like I am the mom of a 3-year-old boy and it's so funny just in the last 3 years, not to linger too long on like manosphere, like all of this stuff, but I guess it kind of is tied to like sexualization.
It
is.
Oh yeah. It's definitely a part of it.
But you know, like there, I was very like, I would never, though people online would describe me as like feminazi, right? Because like they think that if you say that women deserve rights, you are like, I've yeah. never considered myself like that type, but I'll make like jokes and stuff like that. Right. And you know, I remember when I got pregnant, I would joke with people. I'm like, oh man, I can't believe I'm bringing a white man in the world, you know, just stuff like that. Right. And like, but you know, as I've gotten older and seeing it, and it's like Kate says, like, you don't want to absolve or like not admit the fact that like I am raising, like assuming that he is straight, assuming that he is cis, like I am raising someone who has like all the privileges and who like everything happening in the world right now, he is one of the people who has to worry least about his future. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like I also want to make sure that I'm raising somebody who, I think that a lot of people might see that, right? And then they just disregard. They're like, well, nothing applies. I don't have to do this education. I don't have to, mm-hmm. you know? And like, for me, it's like, no, I need to be supporting him. And like, it is my role to teach him empathy and to be there for him and to mm-hmm. say kind things to him. And especially with this, the rise of this incel manosphere bullshit, yeah. it's like, there's yeah. just that constant fear where it's like, I need to make sure that I show up because I don't want to contribute to this like very big problem right now of, I think, a lot of yeah. parents and people like not showing up for their young boys in that way.
Definitely. Yeah. It's, I think it's that thing of, I mean, as we've been talking about with all of this is like recognizing the full humanity of someone.
Yeah, exactly.
And like to some degree, and like, yes, part of that is holding them accountable for things and calling out privilege, but part of it is also like guiding them through it, especially like we've been talking about with like younger men where they like, why are we expecting that they know how to navigate? They don't know anything. They're 12. Mm-hmm. Like that's, you know, they see an adult on the internet speaking with authority and are like, well, that tracks with every other adult that speaks with authority in my life. He's probably onto something, and he's not because he's fucking Andrew Tate. Like,
yeah. I mean, if you do not have, if you're not having hard conversations or like stimulating conversations, they're going to find the people who are. And those conversations are generally dangerous and shitty. So mm-hmm. it's,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
Not entirely.
Mm. Man. Yeah.
But anyway.
No, this is good. I'm like, I don't even know if I want to bring it back around to the actual, like a main topic of the episode, because I feel like this is ending in a good and thoughtful place. But no, yeah, it's just like see people as people and respect them yeah. and know that they are as complex as you are. Like they think about themselves as much as you think about yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I also think that like when we look at ideal types, especially when it comes to what we get in popular mm-hmm. media, mm-hmm. it is just one side. It is usually reflective of the culture right now. It is. And that's why I really do implore people to like explore other forms of media, explore indie film, explore books, explore indie games, explore. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that there is a lot that you can find. The funny thing is, I actually think playing Otome games helped me really find like those areas, or romancing in video games really helped me like define like what I want, what I don't want, because you're spending hours and hours and hours. Like, I'm a Garrus girly for a reason. Like, mm-hmm. he respects me. He doesn't just want my body. He loves me. And I think that, like, when we look at the systems that we have to go deeper, I think that's when we see the vital nature that romance and media does play towards us, whether it's mm-hmm. finding out who we want to be with for the rest of our lives, or if it's just finding out like what we want to believe in. Like, do you believe in soulmates? Do you like, what is more romantic to you? Right. Cause like for me, after seeing so many soulmate things, or we were always destined to be there, I actually think it's more romantic to not have soulmates, because then it means that every day you are waking up and making the decision to be with somebody else. But that doesn't mean that soulmates are wrong. It just means that the stories I have seen and what I've read, that is what hits me more, because it deals with messiness. So I think there's a lot you can get from it. There are stereotypes and there are fetishes, but there's also some really empowering shit there.
Yeah. A quick comment on the soulmates thing. I went to college with a guy who actually his perspective was, I don't believe in soulmates because I remember when my dad was with my mom, and I remember what he, and I know what he's like with his wife now that my mom has passed, and there's not a difference in the happiness. And he was like, so I don't believe in it because my dad got to, like, I believe that there are people out there that are a good fit for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's actually a really, really like sobering take on it of like, but I, like he just, I remember him saying that, and it has always stuck with me. Yeah,
and it's like, it's kind of empowering to know that, like, you know, in any situation, like, we persevere. You know, when you lose somebody who you think is the love of your life, it's like, no, nothing can replace that, and nothing will. But at the same time, like, you can love in different ways, and you can love people equally in those different ways and with the same intensity, or, you know, it's kind of just like a reminder of like human perseverance and how even when stuff is dark and terrible, like there's something to look forward to.
Yeah, definitely. I think that does it for me. I don't know about you guys. Do you have any closing thoughts?
That does it for me. That was a really good episode. Yeah. Jess, as always. Damn.
Yeah, seriously,
coming in.
So much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your patience with my terrible schedule the last week. Oh my God.
No, that's good. I'm glad that we were able to readjust and to have this recording with you, because I really, really had a good time with that conversation. But yeah, that does it for this week. So if you listening at home want more, we do have it. ButWhyThough.net is a whole website full of news, reviews, interviews, all that good stuff. So you can check it out there. You can also subscribe to our newsletter or donate to the site by going to butwhythough.net/support. You can also find us on Blue Sky at butwhythough.net. Everything that you give to the website goes to the website. We're not lining our pockets. We are paying our writers. We are keeping the lights on. We really believe in what we're doing here, and we hope you do too. Anything that you can give is appreciated. Kate, Jess, thank you guys so much for joining me. This was really fun. I'm really glad we talked about this. And thank you at home for listening. We'll see you next week.